Okay, you're listening to Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM. I'm here with my co-host, Ron.
Good morning, Fran.
Hi. And you can call in if you would like to participate in Radio Naturopath. This is a great show about natural medicine and natural health and health in general. And if you would like to ask a question, you can do that. The number to call is 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can text to that same number, 860-486-9487. And you can also write us at radionaturopath@gmail.com. And you can write to radionaturopath@gmail.com at any time. And we would be happy to answer questions from there, because we check it all the time and I have it up here and I'd be happy to answer your questions. Okay, so shoot me questions. Let me know what you'd like to talk about. Let me know what's up for you. Here we are. We are heading into the end of summer, although it looks like we've escaped any incredible anything from Hermine.
Yeah, we just got a little dampness, that's all.
Hermine's
no big
kind
deal.
Of a bust.
Yeah, well, yeah. They do that.
For us, anyway. For other people, I think it was a little tougher down south. And we're going to have some more summer weather. Tomorrow it's going to be in the high 80s, and the next 2 days it's going to be 80s and 90s. So it's going to be hot and sweaty. Yes.
Yeah.
So we still got that going on because it's still summer.
Sweaty.
I did. It's still summer. And so we hope you continue to enjoy your summer. There's some cool stuff going on this weekend. We hope you can get out there and participate in it. I think Sunday is going to be the less good day, which is unfortunate because I'm staffing a I'm going to help staff a ride from Cycling Concepts, the Two Ferry ride.
Ew, it's not going to be a good day.
Yeah, there's a 30% chance of rain.
So that's no big deal.
We don't know what that means.
I also have an event this weekend.
You have an event this weekend,
right?
Oh yeah, but your event,
which we'll be talking about in the next program.
If it rains, it'll be good.
Well, it helps.
They'll like it.
Oh, they won't like it.
It makes it more epic.
Believe me, they won't like it.
Yeah, but if you
I'll
like
talk
mud,
about that later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just it's going to be a lot trickier, but that's okay.
So I wanted to talk about hair, skin, and nails. To start with, anyway, and if you want to talk about something besides hair, skin, and nails, you can, like I said, you can write in at radionaturopath@gmail.com. You can call us at 860-486-9487 or text us to that same number, 860-486-9487. Okay, so I often get told they have nice skin, which is very nice of people. Yeah,
it's probably because of all the good things you eat.
That is probably part of it. There's a few things that go into having nice skin. One thing that goes into having nice skin, when they say nice skin, they're talking about my face. Yeah. Well, that's what usually people mean when they look at you. They're like, oh, you have such nice skin. They don't necessarily mean your arms.
They're looking at the bottom of your feet.
No, and if they looked at the bottom of my feet, that wouldn't be as exciting.
No, it would not.
No,
no offense, but yeah.
No, it isn't.
Well, we walk on the bottom of our feet, so therefore the bottom of our feet are going to be a little more leathered and weathered.
Leathered, right? And weathered and fungied.
Oh, that too.
That too. So so what goes into having nice skin on your face? Well, there's a number of things. So first of all, it's just what Ron said. If you eat well, you're going to tend to have better skin. You know that if you eat a lot of starch and sugar, you're more likely to get wrinkles. And it's very simple how that happens. It's that you have collagen, you have protein in your skin. And if you eat too much starch and sugar, you're more likely that starch and sugar is going to attach to the protein in your skin. And protein needs to be soft and supple. And by itself, it is. But when it starts getting damaged, it gets brittle. And when sugar starts attaching to proteins, you have an event that's called glycation. Glycation is not something you want. When you get glycation in your skin, you get wrinkles. And so so eating too much starch and sugar actually can give you more wrinkles. So the less starch and sugar you eat, or the lower you can keep your blood sugar, the better skin you are going to have. And I think this is one of the mechanisms by which people who are athletic, people who get a lot of exercise, look younger. I mean, there's a lot of mechanisms, but I think that's one of them because they manage their blood sugar better. If you go out and get regular exercise, you're going to be spending some time burning up a lot of the sugar in your blood that you eat, and it's not going to be circulating as much into your capillaries and then glycating various organs in your body. So you tend to look younger. That's one of the ways that exercise helps keep you younger. There's probably other mechanisms too. One is that if you're athletic, you may tend to hydrate more. And by the way, if you want to have nice skin, drink your water. It's a good idea to drink your water.
Yeah. And,
oh yeah. Because if you suffer from dry skin, the first thing to do is look at your water consumption. Are you drinking enough water? Are you dehydrated? Because that alone, if you don't have enough fluid in your skin, it's going to be dry. It's mm-hmm. kind of makes sense, right?
Right.
So that's an important thing to do. And if you're one of those people that, I don't like to drink water, I don't like the taste of water, or I just can't get it down. You know that the...
Really?
You stop getting so judgy. Jeez.
I sighed.
Yes, you sighed and you said, really?
Well, it's just water.
Right. That's your experience.
Oh.
But there are studies. There are studies that show if you flavor water with carbohydrate or something that tastes like carbohydrate, people are more likely to drink it. Maybe that's not you, and not everybody is like that, but it depends on your constitution. It depends on your taste, but I think it also depends on your level of dampness, your level of internal dampness. And we talk about internal dampness in natural medicine. We talk about it in Chinese medicine. We talk about it in Ayurvedic medicine, which is a system of medicine from India. In Chinese medicine, we talk about dampness accumulating, and some people have more of a propensity to accumulate dampness. And by accumulating dampness, that means, you know, their metabolism may be slower, the lymphatics may be slower. That's just naturally the way they are. So fluids don't move through their bodies as quickly. And I'm definitely guilty of that. I mean, I have in the doshas in the Ayurvedic system. So in Ayurvedic medicine, you have three basic doshas. They are Kapha, Pitta, and Vata. And if you have any kapha at all, you need to honor that, and you need to slow down, and you need to you're going to need more rest than somebody who has virtually no kapha in them. Although everybody has some degree of all of the doshas, but someone like Ron has virtually no kapha in his body, so he's he doesn't favor kapha. He favors
kapha.
You're very funny.
I know.
Not coffee, kapha.
Ah, okay.
So you're primarily vata, which means that's you're slender, you're airy, you don't hold on to fat, you don't hold on to liquid, and it's your struggle to keep hydrated, which is why you're so interested in pouring liquids down, because you don't hold on to liquids.
No, I'm not at all.
Whereas I get boggy, you know, and people who are kapha, and most people have a good degree of kapha in them. That's why you see most people in this country overweight. So people who tend to accumulate dampness can have this neat phenomenon of you're thirsty, but you don't have a desire to drink, that your mouth is dry, you want to drink, and then you go to drink, and you're like, I can only get in a few sips. And what's fun, and I have that. I definitely have that where I just can't get the water in. It's not that it tastes bad. Some people tell me they don't like the taste of water. And sometimes I wonder about that, is if it's just the taste of water or if it's that the water they're drinking doesn't, in fact, taste good. And I am sensitive to water that doesn't taste good. Like if I drink water from a city system that's been heavily chlorinated, I can't drink it. I can't get it in. Or if I taste water and has a moldy taste to it because the pipes it's coming out of have mold in them, I won't like that either. But a really good well, we are very blessed to have a very deep well at our home, and we have really terrific water. And it's not chlorinated, and it's got, you know, the right balance of minerals, and it's very good.
Okay, I get the taste thing because, you know, when I lived in a city, that city had pipes that they just tasted bad. It's
right.
Like the water tasted rusty or something.
That's right. There
really
could be
good
minerals in the water coming off
more
the pipes.
Iron in the water or something like that.
Yes.
And then the other day when we were out on our bicycle ride, we stopped to get water out of a bubbler cooler type thing.
Yes.
And it was wrong. It was wrong.
Didn't
it was
taste
something
good
that was a little bit off. So I can understand if your water doesn't taste good, why you wouldn't want to drink water.
That's right. So some people that's part of the issue. But some people, no matter what water you give them, they don't want to drink it. And the studies show that if you put a little carbohydrate, or doesn't even have to be actual carbohydrate, just has to taste like carbohydrate, people are more likely to drink it. So if you need to flavor your water. There's fizzies that you can buy. There's some tubes of fizzies that you can buy that have flavoring in them and very low calorie. They'll have sugar alcohols in them, and you can put them in your water. And if they make you more likely to drink your water, I think that's fine. You can also flavor your water with fruit, with just actual fruit. You don't have to buy a special something to flavor your water, unless that's more convenient for you. But you can put actual fruit in your water and let it sit in the fridge, and it'll flavor your water, and you might be more likely to drink it. You can put one fruit, or you can put several fruits. I have a friend who makes big coolers of fruit-flavored water. She'll put in cucumber, oranges, lemons, limes, and she may put any or all of those into the water, and she has a big cooler that sits there, and then she just drinks out of it regularly, and she's more likely to drink it because it's flavored. That's a very simple thing that you can do. If that's not convenient for you, you can buy little single-serving packets, or even you could even open them up and not use the whole thing in your water. And they are little packets that simply contain powdered lemon, powdered lime, and powdered orange and powdered grapefruit. And you can put those in your water. And then you can also get lemonade brands that are lemonade or soft drinks, and they're sweetened only with stevia. And so that's another way to get your water in, and that's a nice way to do it. And it's non-toxic, and it might make you more inclined to drink more. So we're talking about your skin, and that's a way to get hydrated. To make sure you get your fluids in. The more fluids you drink, the better off you're going to be. If your body has to do something with the fluids, like deal with a lot of sugar, like if you're drinking a sugary soda, your body's going to need that water to help process the sugar. So you're not going to get as beneficial hydration from that. Although you will get some. You will get some hydration from drinking coffee and tea. And it's debatable whether caffeine is a diuretic, although a lot of people, it seems like when they drink coffee, they have diuresis. They tend to go to the bathroom more. So drinking things that dehydrate you can be more likely to give you dry skin, and your skin won't be as nice. And if you're taking a diuretic as a medication, that's going to make you dehydrated too. So when you take a diuretic, you actually still have to drink a lot of water. You have to replace the water and the minerals that you're using.
So what would be a medication that is a diuretic? Are there specific ones, or is it?
Yeah, there are the thiazide diuretics and loop diuretics that are used for any kind of swelling. They're used for a lot of times they're used for blood pressure. They're one of the first line treatments for blood pressure. Ooh. And I just feel so bad for people. When people take thiazide diuretics, they have to go to the bathroom a lot. This makes you go to the bathroom.
So if you take, let's say, you know, obviously cycling is a thing, and athletics is a thing. So if you take your standard athlete who now has to take high blood pressure medication, do they have problems with dehydration?
They can, sure. Well, if they're on a thiazide diuretic, it's not going to be as much of an issue if they're on other kinds of blood pressure medications. So if they're on a beta blocker, a calcium channel blocker, if they're on an angiotensin II converting enzyme antagonist.
Yikes. English, yeah, please.
Right. Well, there's a system called the renin-angiotensin system in your kidneys that involves sodium, the loss of sodium from your body, the retention or the loss of sodium from your body.
Okay.
And when that pathway has you retain sodium so that you retain more water. So because of the mechanism, anything that works along that system could also potentially dehydrate you. So you have just ACE inhibitors, and also there's this class of drugs like your losartan and your valsartan, which are angiotensin II receptor antagonists. They work in that same system. Anyway,
okay.
So that renin, suffice it to say, you have a system in your kidneys that's the renin-angiotensin system, and its job is to hold on to sodium in your body. And if you interrupt that, you're going to lose more sodium and therefore more water. You lower the volume of water in your body. Theoretically, you lower blood pressure. But to me, then you could get dehydrated, so it's a problem. So though anything that works that way, ACE inhibitors and angiotensin-converting enzyme antagonists, like the sartans, losartan, valsartan, olmesartan, those can be more likely to dehydrate you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they can affect your athletic performance, and they can also affect your skin because you're dehydrated. You're getting dehydrated. So let's get back to our skin. So we want our skin to be hydrated with water. We want to not eat starchy and sugary food so much because starchy and sugary food can glycate your cells and make them more brittle and therefore give you wrinkles. We do want to eat foods with lots of antioxidants in them for many reasons. The antioxidants. So when you're out in the sun, you are exposed to ultraviolet radiation. Ultraviolet radiation can damage your skin. The more antioxidants you have on board, the less skin damage you're going to get. It's not perfect, and if you're exposed to very direct sunlight, you still can get a sunburn. Take it from me. But if you eat a lot of antioxidants, in fact, there are studies on taking high doses of beta carotene. If you get a lot of beta carotene in, because the beta carotene will act, it sits in your fat and will act as a sunblocker. And that's part of how it blocks sun. So if you take a high dose of beta carotene every day, preferably with mixed tocopherols, you can have a lower risk of getting a sunburn. Also, astaxanthin, that's another one. It's a very potent antioxidant. And if you take at least 4 milligrams of astaxanthin, astaxanthin is that reddish pigment that's in krill and plankton that flamingos eat and salmon eat, that makes them pink.
Makes
and
them
the
pink.
Reason that flamingos and salmon are pink are because they eat that stuff. And you'll notice that wild salmon are much deeper pink than farmed salmon, because the farmed salmon, they can only give them so much stuff with astaxanthin, and they're not in a natural environment where they're getting it all over the place. Whereas the wild salmon, they get it everywhere. They know just where to get it, and they get lots of it. And that's why they're that beautiful pink color.
And shrimp, too.
Right. Well, when you get your Stonington reds, the Stonington reds are feeding on plankton or something that they're getting a lot of astaxanthin in. So when you see the red color in that shrimp, that's why I like to get my Stonington reds. I'm going to get some this week.
You should.
Yeah.
And you should prepare them also.
I'll peel them and I'll cajun them because
they're
so delicious.
You should.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
Right.
So we had talked about water and how, you know, some people have trouble with water. I have some suggestions of things you can put in water here if you'd like to hear them.
All right.
Okay. All right. So here we go. Starting at the top, lemon and cucumber. Just, a little bit of lemon and half a cup of finely chopped fresh mint leaves you can throw in there too. Put it in the refrigerator overnight. And now you have a lemon, minty, cucumbery thing, which is kind of nice. Remember that party we went to a couple weeks ago? There was some lemon and cucumber, strawberry and lime. Same idea. Use just strawberries, slice them up, throw them in there. One thinly sliced lime. This is all in about 10 cups of water. And then you can add some mint leaves again, which add a little bit more to it. I was smelling some really great mint leaves at the co-op last weekend too. It's really nice. Might have to get some of those for the house. And then there's blackberry and sage. Another way you can do it with a couple blackberries that have been slightly crushed, and then throw in some sage leaves. Watermelon and rosemary. Rosemary is always good. It's very flavorful, so that would work. Pineapple and mint. Apple and cinnamon. Pomegranate, blackberry, and cherry. And strawberry, pineapple, and pear. There's an interesting pear in your water. So you put these in, just let them sit overnight, and then they'll take on the flavor, and then your water will taste not like water.
Right, and you have actual fruit. You're not using any kind of synthetic flavoring or natural flavors, which are still made in a lab and extracted. So that's a really great way to go. One of them you said was blackberry sage. Blackberry sage is surprisingly amazing.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Is it blackberry sage?
Yes.
Yeah.
Blackberry, you said blackberry sage. You can get blackberry sage.
Blackberry and sage. Yep.
Yes, blackberry sage is surprisingly awesome. There's something about the, because blackberries are rather sweet, and the sage offsets it with a savory and bitter note, and they complement each other really well. There's a chocolate bar that you can buy that's blackberry sage flavored.
Huh.
It's great.
Oh,
it's
maybe
it's one of my favorites. Yeah, it's a really nice one. So those are some good advice on how to get yourself to drink a little more water. All right. So how else can you make your skin nice? Like I said, you want to eat a lot of antioxidants. There are supplements that you can take that are antioxidants, like I said, the astaxanthin, the beta carotene. Those will prevent oxidation, but also make it so that when you go out in the sun, you're going to have less oxidation. Now, people who sell skincare products want you to put stuff on to block the sun, because on the one hand, the sun is less blocked, you make a lot of vitamin D, and vitamin D makes you less likely to get infections and inflammation and skin cancer and all kinds of stuff. So if you completely block yourself from the sun, that's not ideal. On the other hand, if you put some kind of sunblock on your skin every day, you are going to get less oxidative damage. That's kind of just the way it is. So, and also, if you put stuff on your face that doesn't necessarily have sunscreen in it but has good healing ingredients, that's going to help you. So I have my favorite skin cream here, and it has really natural ingredients in it. So I wanted to tell you the ingredients so you can see what a natural skin cream looks like. And, you know, like I said, I get nice compliments on my skin. And I don't know how much of that is because I use this stuff. I've used skin cream for many, many years, but I've been using this particular one for a long time, for several years now since I found out about it. And it has no fake ingredients in it. I also have good genes. If you look at my parents, they look relatively young. So I have good genes for having long, what we call long telomeres. That is, the end caps on your chromosomes are long. You know how when you have shoelaces, mm-hmm. they have those little caps on the ends?
Yes.
And they're protective. They make it so that the shoelaces don't unravel. Mm-hmm. Well, you have these things called telomeres at the ends of your chromosomes. And if you genetically have long ones, you're less likely to have degeneration in whatever that gene is. So if I have long telomeres for skin, I'm going to have less skin degeneration. So, and I'm going to appear younger. And genetically, from both my parents, I have that going on. And then, you know, I'm fortunate in that I never got into drinking alcohol heavily. I never got into cigarette smoking. Cigarette smoking is really bad for your skin. There's this awful ad on TV that tells you, you know, this poor girl is like handing her skin over to the clerk because she's to show you that smoking cigarettes damages your skin. And it's very simple. You're causing oxidative damage. You're taking in chemicals from the cigarettes that are basically burning your skin from the inside. And so cigarette smoking is so bad for your skin. So cigarette smoking increases your need for vitamin C. Vitamin C is also something that's very good for skincare, because vitamin C not only is a great antioxidant, but it's a component of collagen, which is one of the proteins that's in your skin. So eating foods that are high in vitamin C is important. You know, your citrus, if you tolerate that, but don't forget, you don't have to eat citrus to get vitamin C. You can get vitamin C from peppers, from broccoli, from strawberries. And this time of year, if you go to the beach, you can find Rosa rugosa, which is just the roses that grow on the beach.
Those
scraggly,
yeah.
Yes, those scraggly beach roses. Well, they grow these big, fat, all roses have rose hips. It's just that the ones that are cultivated to have big, pretty flowers don't have much in the way of rose hips. But the wild roses that grow on the beach, they get these big, fat rose hips that are, you know, they're the size of a flattened cherry. They're good
sometimes
size.
Sometimes as big as golf balls.
Yeah, and they're really terrific. Yeah. And so you can pick those. You wait for them to get ripe. You want them to be a deep orange color, deep orangey red, before you eat them. And there are some who say they're really better after the first frost. So this is a time to go to the beach in October, November, and see if there are any rose hips left. Because when we were at Napa Tree this weekend, and I was looking at the rose hips, and they were not ready. You actually need to wait a little bit longer to get the really good ones. And you want them to be a deep, and it's a wonderful treat because it's something you can pick wild. So if you go to a clean source and you pick a few, you can pick enough and you can make jam out of them. The thing is, they're a little hard to eat straight off because you have to mess with them, because inside they have little spiny seeds. And the seeds are kind of spiny, so that's kind of unpleasant. But the flesh, if you can get the flesh off it, it's really delicious, especially, you know, if it's quite ripe. It's a little sour and rather sweet, and they have the really great source of vitamin C. And when you get it straight from the fruit, the vitamin C is very bioavailable. So that's a great way to go. You can get rosehip solid extract too. That where they extract it down, and it's that's another really great way to get vitamin C.
Right.
You can just buy that made by herbalists, or you can make it yourself. You can also make rosehip jam, which is a really nice way to go. So really high in vitamin C. So, all right. Among other things that you want to eat to have good skin, you want to have, you want to eat foods that are high in essential fatty acids because they're anti-inflammatory and they are a component of your cells. So if you take fish oil or you do other healthful plant oils, they're going to give you good skin. I was talking about taking black cumin seed oil, and that's something that I'm taking every day right now because I'm experimenting with it and seeing what kinds of things it does for me. Because that's antimicrobial because of the thymol in it, but it also the essential fatty acids are anti-inflammatory. There are lovely anti-inflammatory components. So if you have less inflammation in your skin, your skin's going to appear less red. It's going to be nicer. And you're going to have more integrity to the cell membranes. The essential fatty acids, especially in the fish oil, are going to help to support your cell structure. So you're going to have nice cells and you're going to have more oil in your cells. You make sebum, and if you have no oil in your skin, you're not going to have you're not going to have soft skin, and the oil gives you a nice little glow. So getting good essential fatty acids in is a good thing. Eating good oils like extra virgin olive oil and virgin coconut oil can also help you to have nice soft skin. And then applying these things topically. If you can eat it, you can put it on your skin too. Another one that I like to talk about is shea butter. And shea butter comes from this huge nut that comes from Africa. And it's a wonderful creamy saturated fat that you can put on your skin. It is edible too. It's not in a lot of foods, but it is edible. And the cocoa butter is another one. It's fabulous on top of your skin. Cocoa butter, you have to be careful because it's really better to get 100% cocoa butter. And if you get 100% cocoa butter, it's hard at room temperature. So you have to warm it up a little bit before you put it on. But once you put it on, it feels so luxurious on your skin, as does shea butter. And if you find shea butter a little hard to spread, if you're getting 100% shea butter or cocoa butter, the thing to do is to warm it up. You can warm it up just in your hands, or you might want to do the double boiler thing and heat it up a little bit that way. Or just really just put a little bit, turn on the stove and put it on the warm stove, but not on the burner. Just put it in a little dish on the stove where to heat it up a little bit. And then it'll be just warm enough that you can pull off of it and it'll be nice and warm and you can slather it on yourself. So I have this great lotion here. And this is a lotion that has all really good ingredients in it and nothing artificial. First ingredient is water. That you need water in it so it will spread. Then it has capricabrillic triglycerides, which are from coconut. So the second ingredient is an extract of coconut oil. The third thing is olive squalene. So it's squalane. So that is a component that helps to heal your skin tissue, and it's derived from olives. Then it has tocopherol acetate, vitamin E. Then it has vitamin K, phytomindione. So vitamin K is a great component of skin. Vitamin K is something that's great on your skin. It's also great on your eyes, and you can get eye serums if you're concerned about baggy eyes or having tired-looking eyes. You can get serums that are good for your eyes that won't irritate your eyes that have vitamin K in them. Hyaluronic acid is another ingredient. Hyaluronic acid is just a component of your skin. And so you put it directly on. It'll help to heal things up. Then it has some magnesium ascorbyl phosphate, which I'm assuming is an absorbable form of vitamin C. The ascorbyl is, that's vitamin C. And so vitamin C for your college instructor. Beta-glucan is in there for inflammation and immunity. Dexpanthenol is vitamin B5, another component of skin. Chamomile on your skin is very nice because, again, it's something that calms the nerves and settles inflammation. And then collagen amino acids. So you're putting collagen directly where you need it. And elastin amino acid peptide, same thing. So this is a really nice formulation, and it's only available through your licensed professional. And so I really like this stuff, and I have been using it for several years, and I'm wondering if that's part of what's helping me. So you want to look for ingredients like those. The And you want to look, you want to avoid ingredients that are less natural.
And the vitamin K comes from green plants. Is that right?
Generally. Well, this says this is phytomandione. So yes. So it's okay. Phyto because it's, so phyto means it's vitamin K that comes from plants. There's vitamin K2. So why they call, hello, vitamin K1 and vitamin K2. I just greeted the people in Studio B.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah,
that's
nice. On the air.
On the air. Very nice.
This is good radio, let me tell you.
That's some really good radio.
I'm just a friendly person.
Yes, I know you are.
Okay.
I know.
So vitamin K, why vitamin K1 and vitamin K2 are the same thing? They must have similar structures. They don't entirely, they come from different sources and they don't have the same functions. So vitamin K1 is helpful for clotting, whereas vitamin K2 is helpful for all kinds of stuff, for calcium metabolism and cardiovascular health and immunity. It's really good stuff, and I take it. It's a good thing. So, but vitamin K2, vitamin K in general is really good for skin structure, and so on whichever skin you want to put it on. Here's something interesting. I was wondering if you exfoliate. So, you know, your skin, you have 7 layers of skin, and your skin cycles. And the top layer of your skin is the squamous layer. The middle layer of your skin is the columnar, the columnar layers. And then at the bottom, you have the basal layers. And so that's why you hear when you get skin cancer, you can get a squamous cell cancer, you can get a basal cell cancer. You generally don't get a columnar cell cancer. That's just not a thing. Basal cell skin cancers are very, of the cancers, it's a pretty benign one. If you catch it early, you get it out and it doesn't metastasize. Squamous cells are slightly more likely to metastasize, but usually they don't. But anyway, I thought, gee, if you exfoliate and there are cells on your skin that are mutating and could be mutating towards having some kind of an abnormal cellular structure, whether it's simply an actinic keratosis, you know, a process on your skin that is unhealthful from the sun, that if you're having the beginnings of a skin cancer, if you exfoliate, are you going to be less likely to get those? And the answer is it can be helpful. So if you were a dummy like me and got a sunburn, I'm not saying that this will prevent skin cancer, but you can exfoliate abnormal cells. And so I'm going to start a regular program of exfoliating, especially my back. Mm-hmm. And so what you do is you can get shower gels or body washes or scrubs that have granules in them. And the granules can be sugar. The granules can be poppy seeds. The granules can be apricot kernels. And you can get less natural things. And it's good to avoid those. Because there were skin beads that they were using that they were getting in the ocean. And they were plastic. Those are bad. Mm-hmm. But you can get stuff that's made from poppy seeds. And, you know, sugar. And the nice thing about sugar is granular when it goes on. But then when it washes away, it dissolves. So that's kind of a good thing. And so those you can get nice scrubs. And salt is another one that you can use. So anyway, I'm going to get body scrubs, and I'm gonna scrub my back. So I need to get a loofah on a stick.
I was going to say, you need a handle. I
need a handle, yeah.
Or right. A partner.
Right.
I'll scrub your back.
Thank you. Mm. Yeah, you can scrub it right at the exact time of morning when I'm rushing out the door and I'm in countdown mode to get to work.
Oh, but of course I am here to serve.
No.
No, it doesn't work that way.
No, you can scrub it sometimes, but not.
It's a nice thought.
Yeah, it is a nice thought, and there will probably be some mornings where that can happen, and there will be many mornings where no. This would not have been one of them, for example.
Right, I understand.
Because we were both rushing to get out the door.
Yeah, we were both going in bunch of different directions.
Yes.
Hey, I have the top 10 places that you can find vitamin K.
Okay. Yes. Which vitamin K?
good question. K1? What is this? K1 rich foods.
Well,
K2.
If you tell me them, foods. I'll tell you one.
I'll tell you. Okay. We're going to start with number one on their list, and it's herbs like dried basil.
Yeah. So that's going to be K1.
That's K1.
Yes.
Okay. And other herbs would be sage and thyme and parsley sage, rosemary, and thyme. You know,
yeah.
All that fun stuff. Coriander, parsley. Number two on their list is green leafy vegetables.
Yes, kale. Again, that's going to be K1.
Kale.
Okay, that's K1. Salad vegetables, spring onions and scallions.
Yes.
Yeah. And moving on down, Brussels sprouts, cooked Brussels sprouts.
Yeah.
Which we both love. Chili powder and hot spices.
Right.
Another good one. Asparagus, fennel, leeks, and okra.
Yeah.
All right. And moving on down, number seven is pickles.
Yeah.
Cucumber, sweet. So, and we have soybeans cooked. And number nine is olive oil. And number 10 is dried fruit, prunes, that sort of thing.
Yes.
Those are your top 10.
Yeah, and that's going to be K1. K2 is going to be different. K2
right.
is going to be animal stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. So you're going to find K2 in most animal products. You're going to particularly find it in things that have been fermented. So you'll get K2. Gouda cheese is a good source of vitamin K2. Grass-fed butter. Any cheese that has been made from milk that's been where the cows have been exclusively grass-fed, you're going to have higher levels of K2.
Okay.
Yeah, because they process when they process the dairy, they produce K2.
Hmm.
So yeah, grass-fed cheese, any grass-fed dairy product, Gouda cheese. It actually doesn't matter if it's grass-fed because the bacterial fermentation that creates Gouda makes K2.
Mm.
So that's a neat thing. So K2 is a little different than K1, and K2 is more part of the structure of our bodies, whereas K1 is part of the clotting cascade. So K2, that's what you're looking for when you're looking for healing your skin, for building your bones, for cardiovascular health, for getting calcium where you want it to go and not creating calcifications. That's what you want to do. You want
right.
some K2. So vitamin K2 is important if you have osteopenia or osteoporosis. All right. So let me jump over to some sunscreen I find that, you know, even if I eat lots of antioxidants, if I'm in the Florida sun or if I'm at the beach, I'm going to burn. And I don't want to burn because it hurts, number one. And number two, it can increase your risk of skin cancer.
Mm.
So here's a couple of sunscreens. So I have one sunscreen here that the ingredients are stearyl alcohol, glycerin, capril glycol, which is not too bad so far, but now it has hydrogenated dimer, dimethyl carbonate, copolymer, triethyl gum, sodium lauryl, sarcosinate, disodium EDTA. So a lot of these are spreading agents. These are the inactive ingredients. Sodium lauryl lanolate, retinol palmitate, which is synthetic vitamin A, tocopherol acetate, which is synthetic vitamin E, lecithin, aloe, which is a nice ingredient to have, phenoxyethanol, methyl dibromo glutamide, and then some other methylated compounds. So there's a lot of ingredients in this, and then you have avobenzone, oxybenzone, homosalate, octosalate, and oxybenzone. So you have your benzones for your sunscreen, and it's a chemical filter. And the problem with the oxybenzone can be a hormone. It can be an endocrine disruptor. It can mimic hormones. So one of the things that can happen is you can simply get acne if you use something with oxybenzone in it. It is a great sunscreen, but it does have hormonal effects. And the concern about having oxybenzone present is if you have a hormone disruptor, there could be an increased risk of cancer, and the cancer would be a reproductive cancer. But very simply, when you put endocrine disruptors on your skin, you're more likely to get acne. So if you have methylparaben, propylparaben, butylparaben, anything that's in paraben on your skin, you can get acne from that because it's an endocrine disruptor. It can stimulate hormonal receptors and produce extra sebum, and then you get acne. And so even though this product is a sport product and it stays on your skin for a long time, it's got the chemical sunscreens in it. So the other side is to get something that has mineral blockers. And so I have two sunscreens here, two different brands. One, the active ingredients are titanium dioxide and zinc oxide, and they're just optical blockers. They sit on your skin and they reflect the sun away, and they work. Mm-hmm. They do work. And then this one, because it's all natural, it has aloe, it has shea butter, it has chamomile, or not chamomile, it has green tea in it, which is great. Green tea, again, green tea on your skin can help prevent cancer. It has those caprylic triglycerides, which is from coconut oil, and glucoside, which is sugar from coconut oil, glycerin, glycerol caprylate, sugar, that's coconut sugar, glycerol stearate citrate, glycerol undecylinate, all extracts of coconut. Sunflower oil, lecithin, has radish and red raspberry seed oil and some stearic acid to make it smooth and some vitamin E and xanthan gum to help it to spread. So this has much nicer ingredients in it. The one thing you'll find with natural sunscreens is sometimes they don't spread well. So you might have to... you have to work to get them in. But they're worth using if you can use them. And you do have to. One of the things that these two say is they are good for wearing for sports. And they're sports because they last for 80 minutes. But after 80 minutes, you have to reapply them. So you have to remember, if you want them to work for you, you have to keep putting them on. And if you spend a little extra money to not get a sunburn, I think that's worth it. So this other one has non-natto uncoated zinc oxide. And that's the sunscreen. And then the other ingredient doesn't have a lot of other ingredients. It's less ingredients than the other one. It has extra virgin olive oil, beeswax, shea butter, cocoa butter, and jojoba oil. And that's it. So it's a nut that doesn't have very many ingredients. It's really nice. This product that I'm holding in my hand doesn't spread very well. It's kind of thick. But again, if you want to take the time to use it, it's worth using because it's the stuff that's in it is actually good for your skin. It's anti-inflammatory. It's going to heal your skin while you're blocking the sun. So getting a product like this is worthwhile. So good for sunscreen.
And you can make your own sunscreen, too.
You can make your own sunscreen. You can get formulations for it. And again, if you probably the thing to do if you want to be as non-toxic as possible, you have to get, non-micronized. You can get nanoparticles of zinc oxide.
Right, that's what it says.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. And then you put in those nice ingredients in it.
Yeah, it seems like the zinc oxide is the key ingredient because of the reflective capabilities of it.
Right, and titanium dioxide will do that too.
Yep.
Yeah, that just sits on your skin as an optic barrier. And then you can wash it off later.
Right.
Because if it's not absorbed, you just take a shower and you wash it. If you don't want it to sit there all the time, you wash it off. And then there's no worry about toxicity. So that's a good thing. And again, if you have a lot of beta carotene on board and you have a lot of astaxanthin on board, that can help to prevent you from getting getting a sunburn. I actually have a question. Somebody wrote in on radionaturopath@gmail.com.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So Deb writes in that several weeks ago, she's talking about having had a surgical hysterectomy with removal of the ovaries, and then she went into surgical menopause. So she had mood swings that were pretty intense. And it's pretty intense mood swings to the point where she was having unsafe thoughts. And she was given a small naturally sourced estrogen and the situations improve. She's having some manageable hot flashes and then she's going to return to work. Had some psychiatric diagnoses and she feels a lot better with the small dose of estrogen and feeling very well for the estrogen is making her feel a lot better. And stress triggers can exacerbate her psychiatric symptoms. So she wants to keep her hormonal function as healthy and balanced as possible. So she didn't say why she had the surgical hysterectomy with the removal of the ovary. So we don't know if she had cancer. But her doctor decided that a small dose of estrogen would be okay for her. And so what I say is if you're giving someone estrogen, you should also give them progesterone. Because estrogen is a proliferative hormone. And it's really true that the decline in estrogen in our bodies when we're in menopause, whether it's surgical menopause, the unfortunate thing about surgical menopause is all of a sudden these organs in your bodies that are responsible for that, they're hormonally sensitive, they bond estrogen, whether they make it or not, they make some degree of estrogen. Of course, your ovaries make estrogen. And then you have a uterus and ovaries that bond estrogen, and you have estrogen present in your body and being active. When you have your ovaries removed and then you have your uterus removed, you don't have those nice natural sources of estrogen in your body. And estrogen makes you feel good. It helps you sleep, makes your skin nice, gives you vaginal moisture. It helps you with your sex drive. It helps you with your cardiovascular health. And so it makes you feel really good. And that declining estrogen, when you're my age, just doesn't feel good. I'm telling you, you don't heal as quickly because your tissues are not as supple as they were. And so for this woman, she had, I'm going through natural menopause. So, I still have organs and I don't have a health condition that requires me to have that happen. If you have some kind of reproductive cancer, they will often do that procedure. But I don't know why she had the procedure. They will also do that procedure if someone has really bad endometriosis or really bad uterine fibroids. They might do that. Although with uterine fibroids, in my opinion, it's not necessary to take the ovaries. That if you can spare the ovaries, it's a good idea. But if someone has a condition that's not limited to the uterus, where like endometriosis or reproductive cancer, taking the ovaries is one strategy to reduce the estrogen status. So hormonal balance, what you want to do is you get a good practitioner who can help you with bioidentical hormones. And then you measure. You choose to measure either through saliva. There's a salivary hormone test that you can get, or you choose to measure through serum. And either one is fine. And you just pick one and stick with that, and then base your diagnosis and your treatment on whichever one you're using. And so when you measure hormones, I like to measure. I measure estradiol, and I could measure estriol as well. That's a good one to measure because estriol is the least active of the estrogens, and you can have more of it around, and it gently stimulates the estrogen receptors. And so it's a good idea if you're going to give estrogen. So if you're going to give estradiol, which is usually a lot of times the MDs, they only give estradiol, and estradiol is very potent. Estriol is not as potent, and so the risks of reproductive cancer with straight up estradiol are higher if you don't have it backed up by things that moderate its behavior. So having estriol on hand, which is what most of the estrogen in your body is anyway, will help to prevent too much estradiol from bonding and overstimulating. And the estrogens are proliferative hormones. They create skin growth, they create tissue growth, they create nerve growth. And so when you have less estrogen, your mood declines because you have some decline in nerve function. You have a decline in lots of different functions. It's no fun. And that's why you get kind of bummy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then you, so to prevent it from going overboard, you take progesterone. You take natural progesterone along with that. And progesterone makes you feel good too. The cool things about estrogen and progesterone is they stimulate hormone-sensitive lipase so that you can lose a little more weight. When we lose our estrogen and progesterone in perimenopause, we can gain weight. And part of that is because estrogen and progesterone push hormone-sensitive lipase, which burns fat for us. Also, progesterone supports thyroid function. So your thyroid, when you are in menopause, you are functionally a little hypothyroid. You can become, frankly, hypothyroid as well, but you're functionally, your thyroid slows down when you're in menopause because you don't have as much progesterone around. So that's part of the mechanism for weight gain. And so keeping that hormonal balance, again, you want to get tested. If you're already taking a hormone, if the doctor gave you estradiol, it's a good idea to also get estriol. And also to get progesterone, in my opinion. You can also look at your levels of DHEA, and DHEA is a supplement you can get over the counter. It is another hormone. It's made by your adrenals, and it tends to decline with age. And women my age will tend to not feel as well if they have less DHEA, and it tends to reduce your sex drive. So that's something you can measure and take over the counter. If you get the levels up over 150, you're going to tend to feel better. And then testosterone is something you also want to test. And testosterone is neat because you can apply it locally to the vulva, and it can help with sex drive. And because you're applying it locally, you don't need to apply as much, and a little goes a long way. And you can do a little bit of topical testosterone. It can really help your sex drive. So those are all things that I would measure, and I would choose to measure either through serum. I tend to do more serum, but if somebody really wants to do salivary, I will do salivary. The logistics are a little tougher because in my practice, most people want to use their insurance, and there's only one lab locally that will provide services for doing salivary hormones and pay for it by insurance, whereas you can get insurance to pay for serum hormones, hormone testing. So that's a lot easier to do. And it's probably not necessary to do salivary FSH and LH. FSH and LH, FSH is follicle stimulating hormone. It is the hormone that ripens your, that causes your egg cells to develop. So the ones that become follicles and can split and become half corpus luteum and half ovum, so that you, when you ovulate. And then luteinizing hormone, once you do ovulate, the luteinizing hormone will ripen the egg and cause actual ovulation. So FSH causes the follicles to develop, and luteinizing hormone causes ovulation. And those hormones rise very high when you're in menopause, and it's thought that particularly LH is the one that gives you the vasomotor symptoms, that makes you have your sweats and your sleep issues and the hot flashes and the racing heart and all that kind of stuff. So I've also found, so soy is a little bit controversial, because on the one hand, there's a fear that if you have too much soy, it could stimulate your estrogen receptors and you could be at higher risk of cancer. But the Mayo Clinic and the Cleveland Clinic, I was reading some studies, and they say they're not too concerned about soy. If you do a ton of soy products, it can be an issue. But if you do 1 to 3 servings a day of soy protein, even if it's not fermented soy, if something with isoflavones in it, like, soy nuts or soy nut butter or soy milk, 8 ounces of soy milk is one serving. If you do one serving of that a day, I think it helps. And I was having some issues with palpitations, and the last couple of nights I had a glass of soy milk at bedtime. I think it's helping. Something's helping, because I'm doing a number of things to help with palpitations and blood pressure, and I feel a lot calmer. In the last two nights, I drank soy milk with my dinner, and I think that helped, and I'm going to keep doing that and see how it goes. Yeah.
Calmer's good.
Yeah, yeah. It is. And I take motherwort tincture, too. That really helps. So that's the thing to remember, too, in terms of hormonal balance. This lady, Deb, is already taking a hormone. Mm-hmm. So if she's going to take a hormone, she should take some other hormones to balance it and get someone who knows what they're doing to help her balance them. But if you don't want to take hormones directly, there are other things you can do. Like if you're having the vasomotor symptoms, even primrose oil can help. Various herbs like dong quai and false hellebore and hellebore in general and false unicorn can help. And white hellebore and false unicorn. I don't know why they have to call plants false. There are some herbalists that object to that. That just call it true, whatever. Give it its own name. Don't call it false dandelion. Call it, because there's dandelion.
Because
there's
it
false
looks
dandelion.
Like dandelion.
Yes.
So therefore, they call it
false dandelion.
Dandelion.
And it's not.
Just call it yellow flower or whatever.
Give it a different name.
Right.
Yeah. Or give it another name, like there's several species that look like a daisy. So there's
like asters and different.
Yeah,
like
well,
that.
There are kinds of daisies. So there's oxeye daisy, which is really big, and then there's English daisy, which is really small. They're both called daisy. They're just modified by different names. So Bell's perennis is English daisy, and it's got those little flowers. And then oxeye daisy is really big, and there's really cheery, enormous daisy flowers, the ones that grow in our yard. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's oxeye daisy. It's leucanthemum. Yeah, and they're, it's a different species. So just it's a daisy, but it's got a different name. And you know, Taraxacum officinalis is the medicinal dandelion that grows in your yard. But those tall flowers that don't look that have little flowers that look like dandelions but aren't, they're the ones that are called false dandelion, and they have a completely different genus and species name. So interesting. Yeah. So there's lots of balancing your hormones is also about eating well. You want to have a well-functioning liver. If you drink too much alcohol, that's not good for balancing your liver. If you eat too much sugar and starch, not good for your liver because your liver has to work on balancing all the sugar and starch and storing glycogen and figuring out what to do with all the sugar that you're eating. And it's going to spend a lot of time converting either metabolizing that sugar, turning it into glycogen, turning it into fat, sending it back into your blood. And if you gum up your liver with that stuff, it won't be as available to manage your hormones. So you want to have good hormonal balance. If things are flowing through, then you're going to have better hormonal balance. If you eat a lot of fiber, if you eat a lot, and also your menopause is going to go better if you eat phytoestrogens. How do you eat phytoestrogens? Guess what? Veggies, fruit, nuts, seeds, some amount of beans. They all have phytoestrogens in them. They all have phytonutrients that can help you through your menopause. And if you eat more produce, you're going to have a happier menopause. Also exercise. When you send circulation through your kidneys and liver, you're going to metabolize your hormones better. So you're going to metabolize your stress hormones better. And I notice I tend to get less hot flashes if I'm getting more exercise. Stress also aggravates your menopause symptoms because you're getting vasomotor symptoms anyway. And I notice that when my hormones are low, I can think myself into a hot flash. It's really interesting.
You can think yourself into one?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, you can. Because your tendency is there anyway. So if you stress yourself out, you can get sweaty. It's really quite amazing. The stress hormones make them worse. And it's also because you're manufacturing any reproductive hormones that will prevent them. If you're under stress, they can be routed towards making cortisol. So you're going to have more fight or flight hormones, which is going to give you more vasomotor symptoms as well. Hmm. So that was a great question. Thanks for Deborah for writing in with that.
Well, I just got a phone call about DNA testing for Lyme disease. And I just sent you over a link.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. Right. So there's
And caller was asking if you knew anything about that.
Yeah, so that's something I should probably talk about next week. But yes, I heard.
I kind of thought this would be a big subject here. Yeah. Because and apparently the pathologist who's doing this is from Milford Hospital in Milford, Connecticut.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting because, you know, kind of near the danger zone.
Right. That's a good thing.
So, yeah, it is a good thing. So I think that we might want to, you know, table that one for next time because I'm sure there will be a lot of discussion on this because it's a fairly new thing and I guess it's pretty popular.
And I have a friend who had the test.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah, she had a DNA and she told me the name of the company and
right.
She did, yeah. And so, I probably should look that up and talk about it next
okay.
week.
Okay, let's table that one for next week.
Right.
I appreciate the call.
Yeah, and we do.
We'll do that. And because we're completely out of time. Look at this.
Yes. So wow. You've been listening to Radio Naturopath here on 91.7 FM WHUS. 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, and it's been great to be here with you this week on Radio Naturopath. And we will be back next week with more Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM.